Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You see these things on social media. One, the physiques of unachievable, really, but also on the mental health aspect. I realised for me it was not healthy to wake up in the morning and constantly feel negative about food.
Well, we've all been pushed around.
Hello and welcome to It's Complicated, the podcast to help you untangle your relationship with your phone.
Left our hearts in the lost and found.
I'm Tanya Gooden. And each week, I'll be talking to my guests about how they manage the relationship with the tiny tyrant in their pocket. We'll be talking about how our phone habits affect our work, our lives, and our loves, and about what our relationship with our phone might just tell us about our relationship with ourselves. If you want help and you want hope, you've come to the right place. This is It's Complicated.
I'm really happy to be ending season 3 of It's Complicated with this really lovely chat with James McVeigh from The Vamps. He's such a thoughtful and down-to-earth guy. Really, really enjoy chatting to him. He does a lot for cyberbullying and helping children keep safe online. So we talk quite a bit about that. But also about his own issues around his eating disorder, which he's been very open about in the past, how social media might play into that with children and indeed adults at the moment. And then we finished up by chatting about what he's been doing to help us all keep entertained and fit during lockdown. So I think this is a lovely episode to be ending the series on, and I really hope you enjoy it. So James, hi, welcome to It's Complicated.
Thank you.
And it is really complicated at the moment, isn't it? Our lives, our relationship with tech, everything. Of all that, I've been doing this podcast now for a couple of years, and I think now more than ever, all the way we've been dealing with the tech and the digital world is all kind of thrown on its head. And actually, I wanted to talk to you originally because of a tweet I saw back in February about accountability online. And I'm just going to read it out. You said, my thoughts, over 16s only on social media, identification required for every account. This is the only way I can see accountability being enforced online. It's interesting at the moment because I was talking to someone yesterday about the fact there is an increase in kind of trolling and stalking. I suspect we're probably going to see an increase in cyberbullying as well because there's so much time being spent online. So I just wanted to start by talking to you a little bit about your work with the Diana Award and your work with child safety and what prompted that tweet, although you probably can't remember back in February.
Well, first of all, I guess best place to start is I've been working with Diana Award from really, I presume, the very first sort of music that the Vamps released. So that you're testing me now, I think 2013. I'd guess that, you know, as soon as I started having a little bit of public attention, a few organizations sort of came to us all. And for me, it was really weird because, you know, I was a relatively normal boy, grew up in Dorset from a very, I guess, I hate the word average, but pretty normal background. But I'd had like, I think everyone has their fair share of bullying in one way or another. And I definitely fit into that category. So then when the Diana Award, Alex, who's climbed the ranks of Diana Award actually since then, he reached out to me asking if I wanted to do, I think it was just like one video about Anti-Bullying Week or something. And yeah, and that was 6 or 7 years ago. And ever since, I've sort of carried on working with them, and I'm an ambassador. And what the Diana Award do, which is brilliant, is I feel that they are kind of like the bridge between the person that's suffering from the bullying and getting help. So for me, from my experience, I actually had, it was strange because I'm 27 soon. And the main kind of bullying period for me was, I guess, between ages, well, it was when I was starting to do music really. So I guess 13 to 14. So whatever. Yeah. Was that year nine maybe at my school? Yeah, and it was, that was kind of the time when social media, I mean, it was all on MySpace and Bebo.
Over the days.
Yeah, well, whenever I say those things, a lot of the people that, you know, I speak about
just
this
look
stuff
blank.
Too, yeah, they have absolutely no idea. So I think I was really, I mean, obviously there was Facebook and stuff, but I think from the toxicity that we see now, I was at the very, very beginning. And I mean, it was nothing like it is now back then. But so I was kind of thrown into this world of being like, oh, wait a second, the people are saying stuff to me, I don't actually know them. And it was that whole enigma of like, because when bullying was happening to me physically at school, I was like, well, I know who these people are. I can try and go to that. I was quite lucky that even though it really did knock my confidence, I wanted to be relatively proactive in addressing it. So I thought, you're right, at least I know who these people are. I can speak to my parents or my friends or teachers about it, and at least I know who they are. But when it started coming at me online as well, I was like, yeah. And there were people I didn't know from different schools. I
faceless.
Felt really,
like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And I felt stuck. And that's why I think the Diana Award is brilliant now, because they offer that like helping hand to help people, both obviously still physical bullying, but also the cyberbullying, which tends to be, you know, especially now, as you say, tends to be the one that's kind of taking over. And they offer a range of services, but they also do brilliant things where, like, for example, again, you know, a lot of people feel uncomfortable speaking to teachers about bullying, or even their parents or even their friends. So what the Diana Award do is they train anti-bullying ambassadors, which is just, you know, other students at school that can be like a help point, and you can go there and touch base with them and say, this is what's happening, and they're able to then help. And I think when you can speak to people that are in your sphere at school, it's slightly less intimidating to some people than to go to like a head teacher. So that's what the Diana Award do really well, and they've trained tens of thousands of ambassadors, and that's kind of why I'm now still working with them, because from day one up to present day they've done really brilliant work. And there's a lot of stigma, or there definitely was when I was younger, about talking about bullying. It was almost like an uncool thing. That's in inverted commas, that's not me saying it, you know. People like it sort of like avoided it. It was kind of like,
you didn't talk about it, did you? Yeah,
didn't talk about it, and it
pretend
was just,
it didn't happen. Yeah
And everyone was like, oh well, it just, you know, it happens, whatever. But actually the Diana Award, like, no, they've brought in a lot of familiar faces, really influential people, actors, actresses, sportsmen, everyone, and that's really added like a really interesting dynamic to the whole discussion in a positive way, like a celebrity feel to talking about these things, where it's like, oh, actually that person that I really look up to has gone through that with me, and that helps me get through it. So that's why I work with them.
So why did you say over 16s only? I mean, and I totally get, and I support identification, and that's something I spent a lot of time talking about, that anonymity is a real problem. But what's your feeling about the kind of age limit? Because like, there's going to be a lot of teens. I'm happy with the idea that they have to wait. At the moment, they're unhappy that they have to wait to 13.
The schools
that I do work in. So what was your thinking behind that?
It was at a point where I think during that time we'd had a few public suicides of celebrities and influential figures, and I was thinking, like, and actually it's really difficult for me to say something like that, because at the end of the day, a lot of the people that listen to Butter Music and definitely the Vamps are kind of under 16. But actually what I was thinking behind that was, I got a lot of backlash actually from it, which I found quite interesting. And a lot of people saying, you can't do this to 15, 14 year olds. But actually, I feel it's a way of protecting them, because when you go online and the content is, you know, despite the best efforts, actually going back to the Diana Award, like, we went to speak to the Secretary of Digital and Culture like 18 months ago, and we brought about a white paper that actually enhanced the security laws online and made the UK one of the strictest, which is brilliant. But there's still things that you can view online that I think are extremely harmful to anyone, let alone children. And the fact that, you know, during that time of trying to work on that white paper, it took me 3 like clicks to get through to like a public execution. And I'm like, if I can do that, like a 7-year-old could do that. And obviously the sexual content that shouldn't be viewed by people. And my logic behind the 16 age really was, well, how can we enforce it really? And maybe it's to do with a driving license, obviously that's like 17, but maybe it's something like that, something that you can put into the system. And I thought 16, you know, is the age of consent at least. And I thought something has to be done, because at the end of the day, there's so much harmful content on there. It doesn't seem, no matter how much we lobby governments to change it, that content is still going through. So
it's like a tsunami, isn't it?
Yeah. And the biggest thing you mentioned before, the biggest thing that I think allows people to do it is that just remaining anonymous, not having to own up to what you do, not seeing like genuine repercussions. And I think, you know, it's why cyberbullying is so horrible and easy for people, because they don't feel like they can ever be made accountable and they can just get away with it. It doesn't mean anything. There's not like a tangible like feeling associated with it, as opposed to like if you're in a playground and it's happening there and then. So I think finding a way of adding that responsibility is really important. And for me, the only realistic potential of doing that is to sort of, you know, add an ID or something to what you say.
So let's talk a little bit about your personal relationship with tech and the digital world. So you talked about the fact that, you know, you were starting to make music at school. You actually met the band, didn't you, on social media via YouTube, I think. That's how you got together.
Absolutely. So again, I was the generation of the BlackBerry Curve, which was the phone before the iPhone.
Gosh. That is a blast from the past.
Yeah, I know. That was my thing, the whole BBM things and stuff. So I got my first phone at probably 13, and I was one of the last few of my friends. But back then, you know, even before the BlackBerry, it was the Nokia thing. There was no real social element to having a phone. Yeah. You know, you could text, but you didn't have any apps.
That was it.
It wasn't internet. That was it. And then even with the BlackBerry, you could get on a website, but it didn't feel like it does now. So for me, I've been quite lucky actually that I think I only just was at the point before I was brought up during social media. It's like social media wasn't apparent for me, thankfully. Mm. But you're right in saying that it's been like poignant to like the band's formation. So the band started after I saw, well, first of all, I was sort of like scouted by my manager when I was sort of 15 through MySpace. So that was from the off, that was like a social media thing. And then we spoke about creating a band, and I then went out to find a singer because I didn't really want to be a singer. And my first point of call was YouTube, and there was a real movement on YouTube at that time in 2011 or 12 when loads of people were just doing loads of covers on YouTube. It was like a real era of YouTube where it seems there was a couple of massive artists that their sole sort of like career was doing covers. So I trawled through hours and hours of YouTube videos seeing people cover like Ed Sheeran, and then in the end Brad, our singer, sort of popped up, just turned 15 and was on there. And you know, we reached out through, I found him then on Facebook from there, and then for Tristan the drummer and Connor the bass player, it was on Facebook and YouTube. And then as soon as we started writing songs together, we thought, well, the natural thing to do is to put stuff on YouTube. So really, actually, the birth, and saying that as well, the moment that we, because Connor the bass player came a couple months later, the moment that we asked him to be the bass player, we filmed it and put it straight on YouTube. So actually the entirety of the band's formation,
it's
and evolution
is
on YouTube. And you know, from that very first video where the three of us are sat in a hotel room doing I think it's a Connor Maynard cover, you know, and I watched that back sort of like for the first time in maybe 5 years, a couple of days ago, just to like sort of relive that weird point in my life. And yeah, it's easy to forget how much of your life's on social media, but for us, it really, really was. And now, you know, we're on to our 5th album. It's been probably 10 years I've been working on or with the Vamps, and social media just seems to be, well, becoming even more and more of everyday life. Like, we're planning our next album, and there's new apps that I didn't even know existed that the record label are saying, oh, well, this is really important in releasing music now. And I'm like, really? Like, so, you know, that's the thing. It's ever evolving. And it's that thing of trying to keep up with the curve And I think that's also part of the issue why people and teenagers fall through the cracks, because they don't feel if they can't get the latest £1,500 iPhone, then they're not going to be able to shoot the best selfie videos of them dancing to a song or doing something. And then they're
not going to get discovered on YouTube.
Exactly. It's one of these things where, like, I feel it's kind of like climate change. You could argue, like, we're great at humans to kind of like, let's not really think about what's going on yet. Oh my God, it's too late. What have we done? And I feel like social media is kind of at that point now where we all know it's actually pretty crazy and potentially quite detrimental to our mental health. But we've got so far that we're like, well, this is just life now.
How have you coped with that whole kind of explosion in, you know, social media growing at the same time as your public profile was growing? I mean, so, you know, you've now got over a million, nearly 2 million followers, haven't you, on Instagram? How does that feel when you go from, you know, opening your first Instagram account and then, you know, managing this massive audience directly?
Well, I actually was quite late to join Instagram. I remember Brad, who's the singer, and I being like, oh God, like, everyone's on Instagram, should we do it? And we sort of like thought, oh, go on then, let's go on Instagram, blah, blah. Because it was Twitter when we started.
And
I kind of got
it was about
that
two
bit
or
more.
3 years before, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I understood that more because I thought, well, at least, you know, you can see, you can reply to people about stuff, you can share your music. I kind of got that. But when Instagram came along, I didn't really understand. So I got that sort of like, not really willingly. And yeah, it was a weird one though, because we were very lucky that the band sort of was quite successful quite quick. The first song sort of went right up to number two, I think, and the album was number two as well. And it was in the time just before streaming, really. So having like a number two song was like, you know, it was one of the biggest songs in the UK. And all of a sudden, I was the oldest and I was 18. And all of a sudden, we were sort of like thrown into that limelight and we really, you know, I saw some videos the other day, old Vamps videos, and like we were going to like Italy and there'd be like 500 kids surrounding a car, and then, you know, you'd have the same in Japan, and like we still get it to an extent now, but I think because we're older it's easier to deal with. But back then everything was a whirlwind, and that was reflected on social media. So, you know, you could go on social media and tweet something, And all of a sudden you'd have like 5,000 people replying. And obviously a lot of people think that that's brilliant and that's like what it means to be successful. But it's fine when, you know, you're saying, oh, I really like that song from Taylor Swift or whatever. And you're getting, 10,000 retweets or whatever. But then all of a sudden you say something that you think is fine and it's taken in the wrong way. And then you have those same 10,000 people trying to bring you down. And it's crazy. So it took me a long time to actually take a step back. And well, for a long time, I sort of second album time, third album time, I really wasn't happy in it. I don't really know the right word for it. Like, pressure's perhaps not it, but sort of like an unfulfillment I kind of felt. And, you know, we were touring around the world, but I knew that all the time there was people kind of waiting for me to tweet something or put something on Instagram, and it kind of took over my life, really. And it was that weird like imbalance of me thinking that, you know, starting out the band with Brad, I thought we were going to be like a really, really cool guitar band, and social media was never really that like driving force. But then all of a sudden there was like a shift in the music industry where actually social media was on the same level, if you think of like scales, it was on the same level as like making good music. And I was like, that's really weird. And it felt for a little bit, definitely during the earlier years of the Vamps, that actually the scales changed even more. So to look good on social media, to be active on there, to do the latest video, that was almost more important than writing the songs. And that was really strange for me. So I kind of tried my best to separate James in real life from Dorset, that lives with his parents, from James touring the world getting, you know, top 10 songs. And I tried to like separate the two, and it worked for a few months, but then it really didn't, and it spiraled. And it was a bit like, well, I need to actually recognize that what we're doing is really cool. And yeah, it took me a long time to sort of like readjust and recalibrate how I felt about social media and the band in its entirety. And now I mean, it's hard now, obviously, that we're all stuck at home, but and we're always on our phones. But I like to think now that I'm able to say, no, I am in the band. I do have influence on social media, and that's a good thing. And I'm going to try my best to be positive on there, but I'm not going to take everything that I see on there as truth. But it's just part of me, and it's not, you know, it's not James offline, James online. It's just James that just happens to you know, be part of the Vamps with millions of followers. But yeah, it's definitely like a learning process, and it's one of those things where I think a lot of people, we're very lucky with the Vamps. As I say, it's been nearly 10 years, and it's like, I didn't really think it was going to go for this long. I had the best intentions, but you know, you think of bands and you think, oh, they do a couple albums and then they sort of drift off, but we're still here, and it's amazing. I'm so lucky. And we, you know, we've not had any fallouts, and we're like, no, we still really love it. So it's just about, yeah, as I say, accepting that my life is strange, but I share it with some really brilliant people. And it doesn't have to be negative having millions of followers and influence on social media. You know, you can still be a good person and have followers.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Yes.
Do you ever feel a kind of responsibility? I mean, you've talked about the fact that a lot of your fans are very young. Does that ever kind of weigh heavy on you, that you think, oh, I've got to be careful that everything I'm posting is, you know, saying the right thing to, you know, 14 or 15 year olds that I'm,
I definitely didn't at the start, and there's been a couple of instances where things have been misinterpreted or made up or whatever, and I've had a lot of people sort of come at me on social media, and I've just replied and it's just, it never really worked. Like, I tried sort of like added fuel to the fire, and it's like that stuff doesn't really work, because no matter how you feel in that moment or how the person that you're replying to feels, there's still millions of other people that are like the silent audience that just look at that and feel a certain way. And it's just like, yeah, now I'm more conscious of what I do. And actually, for me, definitely Twitter. I mean, one, I don't read through any comments on Instagram at all anymore. But
don't you? That's interesting.
No, yeah. And I was thinking about even just disabling the comments, because it doesn't give me anything. But on Twitter, I do try and limit what I say now to, more often than not, it's tweeting about like a charity thing, or just like a really like boring thing that I think. So like, oh, I just made eggs or something. Like, I don't really. Or actually, well, I mean, you know, I did get quite political, to be fair, which again, quite divisive. But no, I do try and tweet something that I would say. I wouldn't think, right, I'm going to go after, I don't know, Tristan from the Vamps today. I'm going to bring him down, because I just don't think it's, you know, it's not. I wouldn't like to see my idols just like constantly trying to argue with people. I just don't. Mm. Yeah, I think social media, you know, there's always going to be like disagreements, and that's fine. But I think we should all try our best to not be confrontational every moment of the day, which is quite difficult for me. Kirsty, my fiance, will always say that I do love a good argument, but but I don't know how productive it is. And also, actually, going back to what we said at the very start, you know, people of all ages and backgrounds can see everything that I tweet, so. You know, I could be potentially, say, like, offensive to someone that, you know, I don't know, someone my age, or and then like an 8-year-old might read that and think, you know, and I could swear in it. And it's just I forget, and I think the problem is a lot of people do forget that what goes on social media can be viewed by everyone. I mean, it's very easy to forget because it's so easy to post, but it goes back to that accountability and responsibility. And I think we should all feel responsible for what we say online, regardless of if we've got no followers or 10 million.
It can feel sometimes that you're just having a conversation with one person, can't it? And then you, as you say, you forget that absolutely everybody can see it. One of the issues that I get involved a lot in talking to schools about is eating disorders and how much social media encourages or, you know, exacerbates eating disorders online because of that whole perfect body. And you've been very open. You've spoken about your issues around kind of food and body image. What are your feelings about that? Because actually something that I've noticed a lot, so I've been talking in schools now for 8 years, is more and more boys are coming and talking to me about body image issues. It's a real, you know, it used to be girls. Now there's a lot of boys saying, you know, how can I get a six pack like this guy? How can I look really fit like my hero?
Well, for me, you know, it was the same just before the, actually, no, it coincided with the original kind of bullying I had when I was making music. At the same time, I was like, I felt a bit insecure about you know, what people were saying about the songs I was writing. So I looked around me at school and I was like, right, who's popular? And it was the kid, you know, I went to a sports college, it was a sports school at the time, and the popular ones were the rugby players and whatever. And it was the same time that there's a couple of American fashion outlets that like to parade topless torsos on their marketing. And it was a real fad at my school, and I think most schools in the UK, it was like the first time, like California came to Dorset and everyone was like walking around with these shopping bags and stuff. And so I bought like a shirt from that shop, and it was in my bedroom for like months, and every day I think, you know, subliminally I'd be waking up and going to bed and I'd see this bag of this like torso and I was like, oh yeah, like I need to be that. And before you know, definitely takes over young boys' lives. And I think one of the biggest things that I'm starting to realize and talk about is, you know, you see these things on social media. One, that the physiques are, well, unachievable really, unless you have extreme diet, supplements, steroids half the time or whatever. But also this whole thing of like, get fit, stay healthy. And actually, I don't think that fitness and health should be aligned to someone that's got like an eight pack, like, and that's got like 7% body fat, because that, you know, you might think that you look athletically built, but that is not, it's not a healthy one, it's not a healthy physique to have, because what they don't talk about is how bad your skin is or how much you're pushing your organs to lift the weights or whatever, or how unnatural it actually is to have 300 kilograms on your shoulders, like. But also on the mental health aspect, like, it is not healthy to, well, I realized for me, it was not healthy to wake up in the morning and constantly feel negative about food, to constantly have to evaluate, should I eat that, should I not, to be in a really bad mood if I can't eat something, if I can't get to a gym because I'm touring in Japan. It's not healthy to be in a really bad mood with the other three boys in the band, or, you know, or things like that, or not be happy with a picture on the beach with my mum because I thought I looked fat when I had 7% body fat. It's like, that is not healthy. So I think we have to realign, you know, like we're trying to do, and I think we're making really positive strides with male mental health in general. We need to also adopt that, the notion of the kind of gender constructs around how a man should look. I think we need to address that too at the same time. But, and actually what I found really interesting is now, you know, I've met Kirsty and stuff, and we're sort of, I've sort of like ticked that box, it's done, thank God. The irony is, like, she, you know, she sees pictures of what I used to look like when I was like 18, and she was like, I don't find that attractive at all. And I'm like, oh, that's the thing. I think us guys need to realize it's not necessarily what, you know, the people we want us to like us actually like.
I'm really struck that you're talking about how one image on one bag was enough to kind of tip you over into the edge in that. And you know, and you think about boys now at school, 14, 15-year-olds, they're seeing those kind of images 24/7, you know, in a constant stream.
And it's hard as well, because I like to compare fitness to like a millionaire having money, because I was in that thing with the fitness where it's like, you think that you have a goal, and this is what I mean, where, you know, where people say, oh, 12-week diet plan and you will lose 4 inches. But it's like, that's not like the end. The book doesn't close when you get there, because you're never satisfied with it. You know, you can get a millionaire that earns 10 million, but he'll always see someone
who wants another.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, that's, it's not the end. It doesn't just like finish then, because like, you know, I got the 6-pack and stuff, but I was like, yeah, but like my arms are a bit skinny. And then, you know, I try and work on my arms, and then my abs would have gone a little bit again. And it's just like, it's a constantly critiquing your physique is not a positive outlook. Absolutely. Yeah. And when you have these Instagram streams, this explore thing on Instagram is lethal for my mental health anyway, because the things that I like, you know, like in inverted commas, like on Instagram are, say, I don't know, fast cars, dogs, workout exercises. And then all of a sudden on my explore page, it's just all that, but it's like that times 10. So it's like the nicest car in the world, like the most shredded guy I've ever seen. And it's like, it's very easy to realize it. And, you know, I try and be quite vocal about how I feel. And like, I'm honest and accepting that it's a negative way to look at myself. But even I, after accepting that, still look at that and I'm like, oh, like that's really nice. But it's just, so can you imagine someone that perhaps, you know, does struggle from bullying at school or stuff, and they're on Instagram on their own, and it's not hard to put two and two together and see how they end up at that place where they're like, right, I have to do that to fit in.
So talking about fitness and dogs as being two things that Instagram suggests to you, I've been looking at what you've been getting up to in lockdown at home and how you've been entertaining everyone. I just wanted to say to everyone listening to this podcast that you have to look at James clipping his dog's toenails. This is absolutely brilliant, with peanut butter on his head. I'm not going to say any more than that. But you're doing a lot around fitness, I noticed, trying to keep people fit in lockdown. Are you doing any of the kind of, are you doing PE with Joe, or are you doing any of the daily workouts that anyone else is doing online?
Yeah, definitely. I am doing PE with Joe, actually, and that's because my best mate from Dorset, I've got a couple, I don't want to offend the other ones. One of my best mates from Dorset has got a 4-year-old daughter, and he was like, oh, she loves it, you should do it. And I was like, but then I did, and I've done it. Today's the first day, actually. I've not done it in 3 weeks because we had to pick up some food for an elderly neighbour. But yeah, I just love the fact for me, which is, it's obvious looking back now how I got into such a weird mindset about fitness and food. Like, for me, routine is like key. It's like, I'd be rubbish in the army, but I feel like I have the military precision of planning my day to a T. So for me, having routine, even when you've got, you know, like at the start of isolation and lockdown, when I looked at my calendar, everything had just been cancelled effectively, like everything. Mm. Like, we'd probably be in America now promoting new music. And I thought, right, looking at say 6 blank weeks, like I need routine in my life to keep me kind of like mentally stable, really. And the thing I thought I could do is, you know, when this PE with Joe thing came about, I thought, right, every day, 5 days a week, I at 9 o'clock in the morning, I can get up, I can have like a really nice, like nutritious breakfast, which, you know, I wouldn't normally have, but I'd be like, no, I'll do that every day. That's my routine. And then I'll do workout with Joe. And then it'll get to sort of like 10 o'clock in the morning, and I've had a really positive start, because normally for me, I'd get up and I'd go to the gym with my mates here in London, and we'd have a really nice chat. We might have a coffee, and then I'd go and, you know, do the band stuff. And that routine really set me up before coronavirus. So I thought, right, there's no excuse for me to not come up with some form of routine. So I did that. And then I thought, well, you know, the PE with Joe thing is like brilliant, but it's absolutely massive. It's like a monster now, isn't it? And he's so good and brilliant, and I love him. But I thought, well, some people might look at that and think, well, he's been doing that for like a few weeks now, I don't know if I want to get involved. So I thought what I'd do is like a small mini version of that, where instead of, because obviously Joe's like a trained PT and he's brilliant, I'm not at all. I'm just like relatively, you know, normal. I really love going to the gym and stuff, but I'm not like that. So I thought, well, I might start doing something where I'll do like really like easy and accessible exercises with no weight. So stuff like star jumps, for example, I hadn't done since first school. And see if people want to do it with me. And I've got a mate that's a trained PT, and he jumps in as well. And, you know, for any like technical things, he'll help with that and stretches. But I just thought it'd be good to do something where, you know, like, for example, we're doing a workout later on today that a 12-year-old girl came up with that's been watching. And I was like, what are your favorite exercises? And we've done a workout tonight that she's kind of come up with.
Brilliant.
Like doing something that, you know, like fans can do. And actually, a lot of the people that do them had never done anything like that before, never been to a gym, never even done like a home workout. And we're sort of bringing people in, and I'm deliberately doing it in a way that I don't really want to shout about it on like my main Instagram too much, because I don't want people to be like, oh, is James turning into a PT? Because, you know, I'm not. But I just thought, you know, for the people that are interested, we'll do something. And even if only 50 people do it at a time or whatever, it's 50 people that we're sharing that connection with. We're being social, even though we're not with each other. And trying to get some good stuff done.
I see you've been recording some songs for the children's hospice that you are a patron of. And that looked lovely. And I saw one of your video calls you made to one of the...
Oh god, yeah. They that's Julia's house where it's in Dorset. So I used to go to school, I'd say half a mile from that place. I drove past that every day. So that was my upper school. So yeah, every day. And it's like if you live in that area, so it's Poole technically in Dorset. Everyone knows about it. And I've done work with them for ages. But when I did the jungle, Harry Redknapp's also from down there, obviously, and he's like a really big patron of that as well. And I think, you know, when I was in the jungle with Harry, we spoke about it so much, and I thought, you know what, I really need to just do more for those guys, because it's been a big part of my life, even though thankfully I've not had to use any of the services there. Like, it's just one of those things that, you know, there'd always be like fun runs for Julia's house, and I thought, well, you know, why not? It's similar to like the Diana Award. I'm like, well, if I can do something, I should do. And I've done a couple of visits there now, and yeah, we've met a few people. There's a girl called Annabelle who I did, I actually sort of, before lockdown, I went there and sort of surprised her. She's blind, but really, and partially deaf actually, but really into music, and we surprised her there, and it's brilliant. And it's like, that's what like the true, I guess, value of what musicians do, I think, doing things like that. And, you know, it's brilliant to play to 30,000 people in India at a festival, but actually like, going to meet that one person that for them that is like a really big deal. It's actually that's more valuable to me. So yeah, they got in contact to see if I'd do a couple of songs, and I didn't really know what I'd do, because, you know, I don't tend to sing any lead stuff. I'm, you know, more of the harmonies and stuff. But yeah, I did a few songs, and always happy to help them out. And Harry's been brilliant for them as well. So and it's a very difficult time at the moment, obviously, because a lot of funding for charities is not happening. So I think it's really important to also remember those guys in this time as well, because sadly they, you know, their services are still required.
Yeah. And then the look on the little girl's face when you were video call, it was brilliant. It's really
so
lovely.
I know, so lovely.
So, James, I could chat to you all day, but we're all busy in lockdown. We've all got Zoom calls to get on.
I'm glad
online
you are.
Workouts.
I'm bloody not.
So I've got just three questions that I normally end the podcast with. Yeah. So some of we might have already covered, but, you know, might be a good kind of summary. So what's the one thing you'd like to say to everyone listening about their phone and digital habits? What's the one thing that you'd like them to think about? Maybe relevant to now, maybe relevant to kind of when we get out of lockdown.
Yeah, so I think during lockdown it's very difficult to have a bit of space between you and your phone. For me, I find myself just sort of picking it up, which is bad, because before lockdown I thought I was getting into a good sort of habit of not doing that. What I find really effective is, I mean, I delete the apps off my phone until I post. I reinstall them, post them, and then just delete them. Obviously, it's hard. I keep on finding myself reinstalling them, and I'm like, James, what are you doing? Put it down again. but whether it's something as simple as saying, right, for the first couple hours I'm awake, I'm not going to do it, because I think there's a real thing of waking up and going straight on social media that it kind of like sets the tone for the rest of the day. For me, definitely. Yeah. And I think whether you like it or not, well, for me personally, social media doesn't actually really give me anything. It just seems to take things from me. So it makes me feel slightly, oh, I missed out on it, even though nothing's happening in the world. It's like, oh, I missed out because they did that really good workout, or I don't know, that kind of stuff. Or, those people don't live in London and they have a garden. And it's like, you know what, I don't want to wake up and feel negative from the off. So maybe something as simple as limiting your social media usage to, you know, I don't know, don't download it till 11 o'clock and then at 6 p.m., delete it again. Or, you know, if you are finding that you're struggling with the cyberbullying thing, the Diana Award is still working throughout this time. But also, you know, think about disabling the comments, because if you're say you just use Instagram and you're not actually seeing any of the interaction, at the end of the day it's just a photo book for yourself, really. But I would say, yeah, be conscious of how much you're using it. Use that screen time thing that is scary. You know, I think I had about 5.5 hours the other day, and I was like, oh, wow. So that's what I'd say. And then after lockdown, when we are able to go out more, that's when I find it much easier to delete the app. Or actually, what I do now is when we walk our dog Moochie, I'll leave my phone in the house for a couple hours, and Kirstie will have her. So in an emergency, we can do something.
Someone can contact you.
But just be conscious of how much you're using it, because before you know it, I think it is an addiction. And I'm sure they'll come up with some evidence in 20 years when they look back at our era and think, yeah, they actually were addicted to those phones. So be careful.
Brilliant. And what have you learned about yourself from your phone habits over the years?
I learned at some point how insecure I felt about certain things, how I avoided dealing with issues, and actually sort of like how selfish I've been over the years. And I mean, I don't know whether like vain is the word, but like obsessed with being accepted. I think that's something that, you know, we all want to be liked, regardless of where we're from or what we do or what platform we're using. But I think, you know, getting to a point where, you know, if I'd had, I don't know, 50,000 likes on something, that was my sort of like perception of being accepted. And yeah, that's a good one. And then if I put a picture up and it'd get 30,000, I'm like, oh, what have I done wrong? And then I feel genuinely a bit rubbish. And I just think that doesn't mean much. So I think for me, learning that the value of life doesn't revolve around Instagram likes has been a big one for me. And also recognizing that it isn't everything. You know, there is a life out there, or perhaps not at the moment too much, but when we are able to do stuff other than sitting on our phones, you know, that's how you feel fulfillment and enrichment, speaking to people face to face and feeling things, as opposed to, you know, texting and posting pictures on Twitter.
That is such a brilliant note to end on. So I'm going to end there. So thanks so much, James.
Thank you.
Real pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of It's Complicated. If you haven't already, please do subscribe, rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. It helps other people find us, and it means you get a helpful little notification when a new episode becomes available. For more about getting a healthy balance with tech, you can follow me, Tanya Goodin, or Time to Log Off on Instagram and Twitter. And both my books, Off and Stop Staring at Screens, are available on Amazon and at all good bookshops. Finally, for more information about this and other episodes in the podcast series, visit itstimetologoff.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.